And good morning. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie on the local news hour today. One thing to note off the top, if you're trying to listen on our app or website stream, for one, you may not be hearing me say this, but we are experiencing some technical difficulties, so we are aware of that and trying to fix it. It's a recurring issue, and it looks like the first fix didn't permanently remedy that, but we are aware of it. We are on air at 88.1 and 91.7 in Summit County and 91.9 in Wasatch, so tell your friends that they can still listen that way. Temperatures were in the 30s this morning around the Wasatch Back and up into the 60s potentially today, with more on the look ahead. Weather-wise, we have ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes on the line.
Happy hump day, KPCW listeners. It's your Wednesday forecast for the Wasatch Back. We've got lots of sunshine expected for you as we go throughout today. Just a beautiful day overall. That sunshine will lead to those temperatures climbing to around 60 degrees for us today in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid-60s in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into your Thursday, we're going to have a little blip moving through. A weak front is going to drop down from the north as we go into your Thursday. Now, most of the energy with this will be off to our east into Colorado and Wyoming, but it will graze northern and eastern portions of the state, giving us a chance of a few isolated showers and thunderstorms at points during the day. Nowhere near a washout expected, just a few isolated to at best scattered showers and thunderstorms during the afternoon hours. Temperatures, well, they're going to be a little cooler just because of the chance of moisture moving through. So highs only in the mid-50s in Park City. On Thursday, we'll see those highs in the low 60s in the Heber Valley. So keep an eye to the sky for a chance of an isolated thunderstorm on Thursday. But again, nowhere near a washout expected. Moving into your Friday, it's back to the good weather. We're back to a mixture of sun and clouds. Temperatures back into the low 60s for highs in Park City. We'll see those highs back in the upper 60s in the Heber Valley. Now, once we get into the weekend, oh yeah, it is Memorial Day weekend, and it is going to start to feel and look like it around here as well. Temperatures as we go into your Saturday in Park City will climb into the low 70s for highs. We'll be in the mid upper 70s for us in the Heber Valley. The warm-up continues into your Sunday. Lots of sunshine. High temperatures climbing into the mid 70s in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 80s in the Heber Valley. And for Memorial Day, well, we've got plenty of sunshine right now with some scattered clouds popping up in the afternoon. Very slim chance of a mountain shower popping up. But again, I think it's mainly dry. Temperatures in the upper 70s in Park City for highs, and we'll have high temperatures in the low 80s in the Heber Valley. That's your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up later on the local news hour, we'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh about this week's county council meeting in Wasatch tonight. And tomorrow's Park City Council meeting, here to preview that, will be Adam Linhard, the new city manager, and Deputy Park City Manager Jody Emery. We will round out the hour with Heber City Council member Morgan Murdoch, who has a recap of last night's meeting. And Heber City and Park City Municipal are both financial supporters of this radio station. After that, every Wednesday at 9, it's The Mountain Life. This week, Lynn and Mary Beth speak with Alejandra Lara about Equilness. That's a local organization in Silver Creek fostering mental fitness and personal growth through unique programming with horses. Then Brandy Fowers Sacco of Sacco's Farm Stand shares tips for making the most of your CSA farm share produce this summer and explaining how bringing more locally sourced food and products into your meals and home helps strengthen both the local community and the surrounding ecosystem. On The Mountain Life, 9 a.m. today after the local news hour. News next. Families flying to and from Salt Lake will soon have more options to get through airport security together. The Federal Aviation Administration is paying more than $6 million for the Salt Lake City International Airport to expand its screening checkpoints and create security lanes for families. The Utah News Dispatch reports the airport intermittently sets up a family lane. The grant will make it permanent at Salt Lake's main security checkpoint by 2028. Other grants went to airports in Mississippi, Texas, and Vermont to cover family security screening, restroom upgrades, and play areas. And with 100% of the state in drought, Heber City leaders are asking locals to do what they can to conserve water. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports no formal drought restrictions are in place yet.
The entire state of Utah is experiencing drought after what scientists have called a staggeringly anomalous snow year. In response, some communities have adopted water restrictions, and an emergency drought declaration is expected from Governor Spencer Cox soon. The Heber City Council will discuss drought conditions at its meeting Tuesday and is expected to ask locals to do their part to conserve precious water resources. Although no mandatory restrictions are in place yet, Heber City staff say residents should be responsible when using water. A staff report shows the city tries to stick with voluntary conservation efforts unless state leaders or area water districts implement more restrictive measures. The city has a water shortage plan with four levels of severity. Restrictions can range from limits on lawn watering and car washes to bans on refilling swimming pools. For now, Heber leaders say they will follow the state's lead to implement drought restrictions. In unincorporated Wasatch County, special service districts are tasked with managing the water supply. The county will help spread the word about any restrictions that are put in place. The Central Utah Water Conservancy District, which includes Wasatch County and part of Summit County, passed a resolution in April encouraging Utahns to save water. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Wasatch County Council meets today starting at 4 p.m. Here with what we can expect out of tonight's meeting is the county manager, Dustin Graybaugh. Thank you so much for calling in.
Yeah, no problem, Connor.
So one of the first things in the work meeting will be an update from UDOT on the Heber Valley EIS. Am I right in assuming that means the bypass route that UDOT is planning?
Yeah. UDOT is not a fan of the bypass name because one of the purposes and needs of the project is to provide connectivity within the valley. So it's the Heber Valley Corridor.
All right. Not going around then, connecting. But What are you expecting to hear from UDOT? How frequently have these updates been given?
Yeah, so basically since the middle of last year, we've had monthly updates from UDOT on the status of the EIS. There have been a few exceptions to that, largely when there are not a lot of updates to share. We had a staff meeting with UDOT just the other week, and they are kind of in the process of responding to the public comments. I know they received several hundred, I think over 700 comments that they have to respond to. And so they will provide some updates on the status of those responses and I think convey that their ultimate goal is to be complete with the final EIS by the end of this year.
When you say respond to public comments, do they respond to them like in the mail, or is it more just addressing them in their final document that they'll produce with their plan?
Yeah, so my understanding is that in the final document that they'll draft, they have to respond to comments. Now, it's not necessarily each comment individually, but it's each unique point raised in those comments. And some of those comments, they vary in length really extensively. Some of them are dozens of pages long and some are just a few sentences long. And so UDOT has quite the task before them to kind of aggregate and find out what the issues are that people have concerns about, and then for UDOT to respond to those issues in a written format.
I bet they vary in sentiment as well, but I'm sure a lot are concerned if February's tractorcade protest was any indication, since the bypass route, and I that's what I'm used to calling it, will go through part of the North Fields. And so, you know, what have you heard from UDOT environmentally as they've received that somewhat negative feedback about their preferred route?
Yeah, I think UDOT is responsive to the concerns in that I think that there may end up being minor route adjustments to try and address some of those concerns, particularly when it impacts some of the water systems and irrigation systems in the North Fields area. So they have expressed an interest in exploring what some tweaks that would reduce some of those impacts would be. Overall, I think UDOT feels like right now, Highway 40 goes adjacent to the North Fields, and that by shifting this alignment, you know, closer to Highway 40, they're really mirroring the existing impact, that these are not, significantly different from the current existing state of environmental impacts, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's worth also noting the potential public safety improvement of getting that heavy truck traffic off of Main Street. Maybe you've gone into the details deeper than I have on this, but is there any possibility about new exits once they realign the highway for the areas west of town?
Yeah, so I think the county has raised some connectivity concerns around the southern portion of the bypass or the corridor project around 1300 South. It was just south of Walmart. And then what the connectivity concerns look like with Southfield Road. The current draft EIS has Southfield Road becoming a cul-de-sac. And we feel like that's an important aspect of the network of connectivity. And so UDOT is, I think, looking at options that would preserve access through Southfield Road in some form or fashion. So I don't know necessarily if there are interchange differences, but I do think that UDOT will be making tweaks in the final EIS to try to accommodate not just the concerns the county have raised, but concerns that the community as a whole have raised.
All right. Well, we'll watch what the presentation has in store later today. One thing that's up for a vote today is this fence-in, fence-out policy. It'll be read for a second time. It got its sort of first daylight, I think, last week or the week before. What, if any, changes to this policy have been made for the second reading?
Yeah, so there's the fence-in, fence-out, I think, is certainly the majority of the change and the majority of the consideration. There's also a tweak to what is called the affirmative defense. So this is dealing with livestock and assuring people that if they follow normal practices that they are not committing any kind of crime or anything like that. So we have really only made tweaks to that portion of the code from the previous version that was published to the one that is out for review today, just to make it more clear of what those protections are. As far as the fence in, fence out considerations, I know that there has been more discussion among community members. We expect some community members to come with a desire to be able to speak to this issue because it impacts people on both sides of this issue, right? Of whether your property has been trespassed on or if you run cattle that, have access to property that has not been adequately fenced out. You know, there are impacts on both sides of this issue. It's honestly way more complicated than I think, the average person appreciates of some of the nuance of this.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I want to back up if folks missed the first reading of this policy. Basically, if I understand the changes correctly, if you live close to public lands where there are maybe grazing leases or permits, you would now be required to put a fence around your property if you don't want the animals coming onto your property, as opposed to, you know, the property owner or lessee putting a fence around their property to keep their animals in. I'm curious, it sounds like this might be a response to something farmers call urban encroachment. This is, you know, when the development of concrete and buildings runs up against historically agricultural land. Do you have more to share about where this policy came from?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty logical conclusion that most people would take. But actually, the biggest issue are when there are agricultural lands or people own, you know, sizable acreage adjacent to public lands. And the issue is that with the current fence out ordinance, the current fence in ordinance, which means you have to keep your animals within your property, the public lands is a property that they need to be contained within. And so there are instances up on, say, west of Midway or in Wallsburg area that abut public land. So these are you know, large properties, maybe some of them are agricultural or mountain properties that have a sizable frontage with this public land. And it's expensive for either party to maintain a fence on that line, right? And so by having the fence in ordinance, we've kind of made it the responsibility of whoever, you know, has animals on a piece of property to keep them in that property. But as you can imagine, fencing in thousands of acres of public lands is a tall order. And these lessees or people who have these permits from public lands don't necessarily have the ability or the right to make or the means to make significant improvements to the fencing on public land. So that's kind of the debate right now is Do you put it on the private property owners adjacent to make sure that animals stay out, or do you put it on the leaseholders that to keep make sure that the animals stay in? And there are some considerations around, you know, what the animals that are on public land are generally primarily agricultural. You know, they're feedstock, or they're you know, animals that will be used for food consumption or things like that. And so those are some of the considerations that the council is weighing.
I was curious about this. Is it just cattle or any kind of animal that would be covered under this ordinance? Because I was kind of imagining goats running amok on like residential lawns.
Yeah. So there are, you know, a variety of animals that qualify as livestock. And so it could be sheep or goats or cows. I think it tends to be that most of the grazing land is cattle grazing. There are some sheep grazing, and that is an issue in some places where, you know, if you have a large piece of property and you want it to stay on greenbelt, you need to, one of the ways in which people do that is by leasing that land for livestock to come on and feed on it on a regular basis. And there are, you know, kind of rules about how many you need and how frequently they need to come in order to qualify for those greenbelt taxes. So this is an issue, you know, kind of everywhere that has those large acreages that have these types of agricultural operations. But I think most of them, or at least a significant number of them, won't be impacted by this change. They will still be required to fence in their animals. It's really just the ones adjacent to public lands and that interface with public land.
Gotcha. I was hoping you could say more about green belt impacts, because hypothetically, if this passes, would this expand who would maybe automatically qualify for greenbelt, because you just don't have to put a fence up and you can show that, you know, you might have some grazing happening on your property?
Fencing is one of the features of greenbelt that we use to try and evaluate, you know, the reality of an agricultural operation, right? That there are some types of agricultural operations that you probably would need fencing to make it feasible that, you know, animals are actually on the property. And that's one of the things that what we're trying to do is be fair in how we apply greenbelt benefits. So for those people who don't know, if you have a sufficiently sized agricultural operations, and it can range in size from very small to very large, you can receive significant tax reductions on the property. It's based on the agricultural economic value instead of the market value of the property. And the idea is that this makes operating a farm more financially feasible, because you're not paying taxes on what it could be. You're instead paying taxes on what it's currently being used as. So I don't think it will have a big impact on whether a property qualifies for greenbelt taxes or not. I think overall, the desire of the county council is to promote agriculture. And there is just a reasonable debate on which side of this issue does that better.
All right. And will there be a public hearing on this? Any input tonight?
I expect the council will take public input. I don't believe it's a public hearing, but I think that there are people coming that the council will want to hear from.
All right. Moving on, one thing getting read for the first time is changes to your grandma ordinance. That's the Government Records Access and Management Act, essentially how citizens can request public records from the government. And it sounds like the county is receiving a lot more of these. This is not new, and you hired someone last year to handle the increased volume. So is the change contemplated today just sort of making certain changes permanent, or further changes on top of that?
Yeah, so I think you'll find across the state of Utah, government entities have received an increased volume of grandma requests, you know, spanning over the last, say, 5 to 10 years, the volume has just increased significantly. And so for Wasatch County, when I first got here, we had actually our budget officer, just as part of their duties, was managing grandma requests. And that was a reasonable accommodation, you know, that we could do our accounting and address grandma with a single person. And we've slowly made incremental changes to try and handle, as the volume has grown, how we do this. And it wasn't until this last year that we kind of finally pulled the trigger and have just a person whose full-time job is just managing these information requests. So what the change does is moves the by county code that responsibility. It had been previously with our clerk auditor's office, and because of the workload, we had split it between the clerk auditor's office and the sheriff's office. And what this change would do is consolidate that now in the attorney's office, which is something that we found, you know, for instance, Utah County does. They manage their grandma through their attorney's office. So we have a employee there who is a paralegal and is able to work with our attorney's office on processing these grandma requests and kind of being that single point of contact. So we can make sure that we are responding promptly and appropriately to grandma requests and trying to do it in the most efficient way possible.
That sounds similar to the way that Summit County does it. And I believe they hired a grandma employee last year as well. I'm curious, when you talk to other counties and you say this is an increase in volume of requests statewide, say at the Utah Association of Counties, do you have conversations about, are these coming from similar sources, completely disparate ones?
Yeah, I think the overall sense is that it's just a wide variety of users. So there are not, like, at least Wasatch County doesn't have individual, high utilizers, but many of our public safety interactions get grandma'd because it's, you know, involved in some kind of legal action or some kind of dispute. And so those are very cumbersome to go through because you have to make sure that you're protecting, you know, people's identifying information appropriately or redacting things where necessary. And so that requires a review of, you know, law enforcement officers and attorneys. And, you know, sometimes we get requests for large volumes of emails, and that is a very cumbersome process to go through hundreds or potentially even thousands of emails and evaluate whether or not there is private identifying information in them and if any of that was privileged or protected or related to any legal matters. Another big driver actually is it seems that many property owners, when they buy a property or are interested in buying a property, are grandma requesting all of the information associated with the approvals and permits and things associated with that property. And so we get a lot of grandma requests related just to construction of regular homes, and all of these things kind of compound together to kind of necessitate this expenditure.
So it's sometimes people or their realtors doing due diligence, making requests?
Yeah, and I don't know necessarily that they have anything specific that they're looking for. I think it maybe just is due diligence that they're saying, well, I'd like to see what the plans were and what the approval process was and what the minutes from the meeting that it was approved at were. And all of those things take time for someone to go look at and pull.
All right, Dustin. Well, we're close to out of time, but is there anything else coming up tonight that you think residents should be aware of?
There's a number of things on our agenda. I think the council is evaluating changes to our Parks and Recreation impact fee. And I think it's important for people to know that we are trying to be as fair as possible and ensure that we are maintaining. So this is, you know, not expanding our level of service, but maintaining our level of service and trying to share the load so that new homes pay their fair share of those new facilities so that we can maintain our current level of service. And so I imagine we'll have some fair amount of discussion about that tonight.
All right. Well, you can see the agenda posted online. Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Park City High School's head baseball coach is stepping down, and KPCW's Christine Weller reports that athletics director Jamie Sheets is slated to take over the role.
Park City High head baseball coach David Fiesler is stepping down after 10 seasons with the team, but he won't go far.
I'm planning to stay on as an assistant coach, but just step down as the head coach, get some time back in my life, and hopefully pursue some other things.
He will also continue teaching business and economics at the high school. Fiesler has been involved in baseball all his life. He played at Park City High and in college. He began coaching after college and eventually returned to Park City. Here, he's had a successful career as head coach, leading the Miners to 157 career wins, 3 region championships, and a third-place finish in the state competition. His favorite part of being with the team, however, is working with the students.
We graduated 62 kids from the program in 10 years. 19 of them went on to play college ball, but even the kids that aren't playing college ball, it's been so fun to just follow their journeys after Park City High School.
One of his students went on to play minor league baseball. Athletics Director Jamie Sheets will take over the head coaching role. With Fiesler remaining on as assistant coach, the school says the program is positioned for a seamless transition. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Here in the studio now are Deputy Park City Manager Jody Emery and Park City Manager Adam Linhard. Thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
All right. Well, the City Council meets starting at 5:30 tomorrow for its regular meeting. And one of the last things that we'll be considering is the City Council's own salary. And I think a lot of people roll their eyes on social media and say, of course, it looks like they're considering doubling those salaries. But why is this coming up now as opposed to before or later?
That is an item on the council agenda tomorrow, and it's a legitimate policy question for any community to look at its compensation for its elected officials to make sure that that compensation accurately reflects the demands of the position. It's been a minute since the council has had a significant update to its pay and compensation. The last comprehensive update took place in 2014. That was fiscal year 2015, the way that we account for that. So it's been a little while. In the interim, there have been some periodic cost of living adjustments. Overall, I would say pretty minor increases since 2014. And in conversations with the council, we have certainly heard, I would characterize them as concerns about the compensation. All of the elected officials, I think, have, their own unique opinions on this matter. And what we're doing on the council agenda is we're holding a public hearing. I think the beauty of this item is that, these decisions aren't made in a vacuum, but they are subject to a public process. It ensures that these conversations happen in public, that deliberation takes place in a public meeting. We do have a public hearing so the public can weigh in. Until that conversation happens at the meeting, I couldn't presume what any increase might be. That's what that item on the agenda is intended to do. We do certainly understand that the demands on elected officials' time are pretty significant, and so that conversation will take place. What we have in the tentative budget, we have some numbers that we are in there to attempt to capture any potential increase. What that actual dollar amount will be, we'll get some clarity as the process plays out.
All right, so subject to change, because this is part of the larger fiscal year 27 budget discussion, but just so people know the numbers, councilors make about $28,000 annually.
Correct.
Right now. It would go up to $58,000. The mayor would go from $55,000 to $116,000. The lower numbers sound to me like the camp where, public service is a service, kind of like a volunteer position. The larger numbers make it sound like a professional job. I mean, do you all have opinions as staff about which is it as an elected?
Well, the perspective that we gain as staff is that we work with the elected officials on a daily basis. We see the amount of time that they put into the position. I think it is fair that any current or previous elected official could speak to the demands of the position. I would say that those demands have increased over time. The mayor, in particular, is the chief executive officer of the city. I would say he's probably at City Hall nearly every day.
And he's in office there as well, right?
Correct. Yeah. I think the mayor's probably always had an office at City Hall, as far as any of us know. But it is a position that requires a lot of work. And I think the community benefits from that public service. Anyone who is willing to step into that role these days, I appreciate that. I have perspective in my position of working closely with them and seeing what they do. So I think public service is highly valued. I think the community benefits. And in terms of exact dollar amounts, I think that's a value judgment for the elected officials. And they'll have that conversation, and we'll see where that lands.
All right, and for folks that want more information, of course, this agenda is also posted on the city website. I want to move on to the recycling ordinance that's on the agenda. Is this finally up for approval tonight?
It's up for approval tomorrow night. Yep.
Okay, tomorrow night, sorry. So what's the status quo maybe right now with recycling at businesses in town? Is it optional right now, and is this just making it mandatory? Is that too simple?
No, that isn't too simple. That sums it up pretty neatly. But ultimately, this is focused on two different things. It's focused on all businesses with a physical address within Park City, and it's also focused on waste hauling. So the goal is to extend the life of our our Summit County landfill, and to at the same time improve recycling rates. So this ordinance hopes to achieve both of those goals.
The ordinance looks like it applies to businesses that you're calling waste generators. What's a waste generator? I think there are like a lot of people, everybody's a waste generator on some level. So who are you including in the ordinance?
That's correct. So a waste generator is any business that produces waste from a physical address in Park City. And that could be, you know, as simple as paper waste from if you're doing tax preparation or something like that. But it can also be, up to a landscape business who's producing land waste, like green mowing trimmings. So that's home-based businesses, however, that exclusively use Summit County residential curbside service are exempt. That's important to note. So if you have this service, waste hauling service, already at your house and it's a home-based business, you will be exempt from this requirement.
Because it looks like you can comply by self-hauling to Recycle Utah, for example.
Correct. Yes. So talking a little bit about the waste and recycling haulers, they're going to have to register with the sustainability department at the city. They're going to have to identify what materials they haul, how much they're hauling, and where they are taking that waste. And they must deliver recycling to facilities that divert more than 50% of by weight from a landfill. Those are some of the requirements. And you can self-haul, but you will have to register like any other hauling company with the city.
How much does it cost to register, and what other costs are there?
I don't know that there's a cost associated with it.
For the waste haulers,
I don't believe
cost.
No.
But
no.
For the business side, like you're contracting with the hauler, so this...
It's going to be part of your business licensing process.
Gotcha.
So you can, for your commercial businesses, I'll talk a little bit. So you must show proof of active trash and recycling services at the business license application or renewal through one of three pathways. You can do direct accounts with authorized haulers. You can have membership in a master association like the HPCA on Main Street. That provides proof of service, and you can also self-haul like we talked about, which requires just registering as an authorized hauler.
Okay, and so the licensing fee wouldn't go up then? This is just an accounting type
Correct.
Thing? Okay.
Yep.
If someone needs more information about where their business falls in the ordinance, who can they contact?
Well, if this passes tomorrow night, we will put all of the information on the Park City website, and that will be available through the Sustainability Department.
All right, fair enough. I wanted to touch on two things on the consent agenda, since that doesn't frequently get a lot of discussion. But just ahead of time, it looks like the council may approve a new downhill bus stop at the Montage for the Purple Line. Some signage is also included in that. What are we looking at as far as changes in the Marsac corridor for transit?
Yeah, great question. So we're looking at a total of 55 signs along that entire corridor, which is a pretty lengthy amount of road. What we see up there is a lot of illegal parking, a lot of erosion that's caused by people pulling off the road. Every time somebody does that, it makes that area look like, oh, you know, that's a legitimate parking space. And then we get people that are up there, oftentimes blocking traffic during peak season, makes it difficult for the bus to get up there. So 55 signs, I would say that they're fairly discreet. That's the intention, at least. But we're posting these signs in the right-of-way, so all on public property. And it's just intended to keep people out of places that they shouldn't be parking that are currently illegal. It's better notification to them so they can be aware that, well, yeah, this looks like a parking space, but it's signed, so I know that I can't park here. It directs people to park in the designated parking areas. And then, of course, the bus stop at the Montage, this will make that bus stop ADA compliant, bring that up to code.
All right, the other item is the Fauston, related to the Fauston Spur Trail, and a bridge that UDOT's contemplating over State Route 248,
yes,
where the rail trail hits
mm-hmm.
it. Mm-hmm. The council may throw its support behind this plan tomorrow. So what's the likelihood? Because it's all UDOT's decision. What have you heard from them?
Yeah, so this is a UDOT-directed project, and what's being requested of the city right now is a letter of support because part of the trail is within Park City's jurisdiction. And so this is for our listeners who may not be familiar with the Fauston Spur Trail. So this is on the east side of I-40. or Highway 40, and right where the rail trail crosses 248. So this would add a pedestrian crossing over 248. I think that would be a great improvement for our trail users. The addition of, it'd be more of the multi-use pathway along the Fauston Spur.
And it looks like that would connect the rail trail to like the park and ride in Richardson Flat? Mm-hmm.
Yes, and then continuing north.
You know, have you heard from UDOT about the design of an overpass, pedestrian overpass yet? Because some of the ones in the Wasatch Front, fairly large. I'm not sure what their options are at their disposal.
Yes, right now the project's going through the public scoping process. It's very early. They do have a project page. UDOT's got that on their website. In fact, I jumped on that earlier this week. And they've got a lot of information, a vicinity map. You can see the route that's proposed, and they discuss some of the improvements. As far as the actual design for a pedestrian bridge, I don't believe we're to that stage yet. I couldn't speak to that directly as far as how far along UDOT might be, but that'll be something to keep an eye on for those trail users in that area.
Design is planned for 26-27, so all that right. would come Thanks, after Jody. The environmental review.
Great. Anything else you want to mention, Jody and Adam? I know there's a new city website coming from the staff level at some point, mm-hmm. but any
it's
other
live.
Updates?
It's live.
It's live.
It's
okay.
live, and we're working through the kinks, so bear with us if you're trying to find something, if it's a little more difficult. It's going through a process of indexing.
Okay. I believe it was consolidating, the library and police department into the city website?
It's just an complete upgrade for our website. We're pretty proud of the new website.
All right. So residents can go search for the council agenda there.
There you go.
Correct.
All right. Adam Linhardy's the Park City Manager, and Jody Emery, Deputy City Manager. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks
for having us.
And on the phone now is Morgan Murdoch. He's on the Heber City Council, which met last night. Morgan, thank you so much for calling in early, since I understand it was a pretty late meeting.
Good morning, Connor. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Yes, it was a long meeting from 4 p.m. until 10:30.
All right.
So it was a late night, but I think it was very productive.
Impressive. So one of the things I wanted to ask you, since you're on the committee regarding this, is dogs in parks. Can you, update? It's surprising to me. Maybe residents don't know, but dogs have previously not been allowed in Heber City parks, and so you're thinking of changing that.
That's correct. So, Heber City's a mountain town. We're neighbors with Park City, so I know it's surprising to many. But that's correct. They're not allowed in the parks, with the exception of Muirfield Park. There is an enclosed, fenced area where dogs are allowed off-leash. There's a section for small dogs and a section for large dogs. But that's it. So the city did a little survey last summer during the Market on Main, and they were able to obtain some feedback from residents. And the assistant city manager shared that information with the council during our January retreat. And the council decided this is important. And so we made it one of our priorities. And as part of that, the city created an ad hoc animal policy committee. And I've raised dogs for over 20 years, and so I'm passionate about it, and I jumped in, volunteered to be a part of that committee, and it's been really productive. We've only had 3 meetings, but making up that committee is the assistant city manager, the manager of city parks, director of animal services, deputy chief from the Heber City Police Department, a member of the post committee, and the director of CAMS, and then myself. And it's really been good. We've had some great discussion. We've been brainstorming some things. Last night, the assistant city manager did give an update in the meeting, and part of that that we're proposing is 4 city parks that would allow dogs on leash. We're proposing a 6-foot leash maximum, and these parks would be throughout the city, primarily on the east side and in the south, because currently the county does allow parks on leash, to my understanding, including Southfield Park, which is a very large area on the west side. An additional recommendation from the committee is to create some additional fenced areas for off-leash.
And real quick,
we're looking at is just north of the Jordan Park in the Red Ledges area, and then the Jones Park down south in Wheeler Park.
Morgan, you're mentioning leashes. I'm curious about e-collars. Sometimes that is a legally acceptable substitute. If you have a physical leash in your hand, you can also have your dog on an e-collar. Any discussion about that?
Now, that's a great point. The committee has not yet discussed that. At this point, we've just talked about a 6-foot maximum, and we are allowing, we're suggesting that we allow retractable leashes as well. Those are very popular, commonly used. However, those can extend up to 30 feet or more. And so the guideline would be make sure you keep it at 6 feet.
All right.
But you bring up a great point, and I'm gonna raise that with the committee. Thank you.
Saturday, I believe, is the trial run for dogs in the main city park. What's slated for May 23rd?
Yes. So May 23rd is a dog's day in the park, and this is sponsored by CAMS, Community Alliance on Main Street, with the support of city and other organizations. And so this would be held at Main Street Park. Currently, the committee is not recommending dogs at Main Street Park, so this is definitely an exception, which the council approved. So even though there's a policy against dogs in parks, it's been approved for this 2-hour event. So this Saturday from 10 to noon, they're going to have a dog costume contest. They're going to have dogs versus owners look-alike contest. There's going to be canine demonstrations and interactive games, and there will be various booths from different animal welfare groups. We've got Paws for Life and Nuzzles coming. So we're hoping for a good turnout. We're hoping for good weather. And this is sort of an opportunity to kick this off and just invite dog owners out and have some fun, get some feedback from them, and also make them aware that we are looking at this policy and hopefully opening it up for more dog-friendly parks in the future.
All right. Last night, Mountainlands Community Housing Trust, one of the nonprofits focused on housing in the Wasatch Back, appears to have created an affordable housing university for the Heber Council. So last night was the first of 9 lessons in affordable housing. Why did the council decide these classes with Mountainlands were needed?
Again, in our January retreat, we talked a lot about affordable housing as a very high priority. This is something that we're talking about and working on regularly. And so we decided that this would be very helpful to educate ourselves more in this area. And so Jason Glidden, the executive director of Mountainlands, in collaboration with our city manager, has been working on putting this itinerary together. And so, yeah, last night he kicked it off, and I thought he did a great job presenting. We had a good discussion. And like you said, this will go on each month for 9 months. And basically it's to help equip the city council with financial, regulatory, strategic knowledge, and on various topics, financing, federal, estate, local resources, to help us really come up with a plan and a framework. I think one of the most exciting parts of this whole University 101 for affordable housing is that the city wants to collaborate with the county and have a needs assessment done. So that was part of the discussion last night, and that's coming up as one of the topics, is to have this needs assessment conducted, which will give us an idea of what the needs are in our community for housing as we look at partnerships and as developers approach the city. We want to figure out what product is needed and where it would make sense to build it.
Regarding that assessment, are you looking to see if there's a need or how much of a need? What's your sense of it right now?
Yeah, we know there's a need, but it's looking at the demographics. It's looking at the products, the different areas. And so that's why we want to collaborate with the county. It wouldn't make sense to spend this amount of money, which could be in the ballpark of $40,000 to $50,000, was estimated, to do it just for the city limits. And so we want to work with Wasatch County and other entities and make this a comprehensive housing assessment. I also sit on the Wasatch County Housing Authority, And we just discussed this on Monday. And so there's some great collaboration going on this. They're going to put out an RFP. And so hopefully we'll have more information this summer.
All right. So once you have an assessment and once you've graduated from Affordable Housing University, what's the policy direction from there? Do you think you'll set some sort of goal? Do you think you'll then maybe solicit certain projects to whatever extent that you can on maybe city-owned land?
Yeah, so you'll notice in the packet, you know, from last night's meeting, you can see the syllabus, you can see the different topics that we're going to cover, and the very last item is goals and creating a plan for Heber. But we're not necessarily waiting for 9 months before we do anything. The council's continually working on this. There's different projects that are being proposed. Developers regularly come to the council and propose different affordable housing type projects. And so we continue to discuss those and weigh the pros and cons. Russ Watts with Celebration Housing Development, that's something that's come up in the past, and I think it will continue to come forward to the council. And so I'm interested in learning more about that project and others. But there's a few in the works.
All right. I understand there was an animated discussion about the TAP tax last night. You know, this is the tax that Summit County residents might know as RAP. I think in Salt Lake it's ZAP, but it's TAP in Wasatch for Trails, Arts, and Parks. So the council discussed it and the allocations of grants. What sorts of TAP projects will be funded this round?
Yes, that's a great point. And I'm just pulling that up real quick as a reference.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'll ask you about the discussion. Councilmember Mike Johnston said he believes the city should consider dedicating a higher percent of the funds that you gather through this tax, which I believe is a sales tax, to the arts. Right now it's 10%. What's your sense on that?
Yes, I did express sentiment last night in the meeting to raise that to 15% as well. There were a number of council members who expressed that. It's arts, trails, and parks. And I think they're all very important, and there's a lot of needs there. But there was quite a bit of discussion about the arts. We've got 8 or more performing groups in the valley. It's just really grown. There's limited rehearsal and performance space. And so we have different groups looking at different projects. And there's definitely some need there to support the arts. It's very important in the community. And so I spoke to that last night, but yeah, I agree. We need to up it. Mike Johnston referred to the fact that the 10% was just sort of a starting arbitrary amount. And we all believe, most of us believe, that there's a need for some more funding there. The committee did present different projects that have been proposed, and that totals about a little over $119,000. If we stuck with the 10% allocated, that would be about $66,000. And so that was our big discussion last night, is do we stick to the 10% and just cut these other projects and say no, even though we do have available TAP tax funds, or do we go ahead and approve? And we voted to go ahead and approve these projects, and then we will revisit this discussion. And it looks like we did tell staff that we want to up this to 15%. So that's something that will be addressed.
All right. Why do you think the Heber Valley is so theatrical? 8 performing arts groups feels like per capita probably more than most in Utah.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think part of it is just the growth of our valley. The different demographics. There's a lot of families. There's a lot of youth. As you can tell with the new high school, we had nearly 3,000 students in Wasatch High School, and there was, you know, sort of bursting at the seams there. And so there's a lot of youth, a lot of talent, and creative expression. Last night I mentioned that 18 years ago, my family and I moved here to Heber Valley. And there were a couple of big performing groups. And I jumped in and got involved, and my family's been involved, and we've performed with multiple companies in the Valley. And it's been such a wonderful experience. Community theater is amazing, but it's interesting to see how much growth there is. And I think the other thing, not just talent, but the community loves it. They want it. They want to, you know, these performances are well attended, even though there's multiple going simultaneously, including the high school performances. So there really is an appetite for it. They just love performing arts.
All right. Councilmember Morgan Murdoch, thank you so much for checking in about last night's Heber City Council meeting. That's where we've got to leave it.
Great. Well, thank you again, Connor. It was a pleasure.